Welcome to the first episode of the I Am Cognac podcast, where we aim to get a glimpse of life from all parts of our extended Cognac family. My name is Tyler Agafonov. I'm the communications coordinator at Cognac and a descendant from the Torsen family from the village of Usinki. If you're familiar with Cognac at all, today's guest likely needs no introduction. He has served in many different capacities over his 35 years here at Cognac, including serving on the board of directors, working as corporate affairs manager, vice president of business operations, president and CEO of Cognac subsidiaries, and Cognac's president. Currently, he serves as Cognac's regional and legislative affairs executive and our resident expert on all things Cognac, Tom Panamiroff. Thank you for joining us, Tom.
Good to be here, Tyler.
Thank you. In this episode, I wanted to hear about your personal background, your time here at Cognac over the years, and what you do in your role today. So, first question, your title is regional and legislative affairs executive. Can you just give us a general description of what that means and what you do?
Yeah, I'll try. It's pretty broad, but what I view it as is being a person who works with our villages, our village corporations, our tribes, and trying to bring issues of importance to them or help them with issues or needs that they have, and kind of being the conduit between Cognac and our communities and our corporations and our tribes. What's not reflected in that title is I also oversee our lands department, so our lands manager reports to me. So that's another part of it that's not reflected in the title.
We've heard more about advocacy from Cognac lately over the past few years, and you know, even up to today. Why would you say it's important for Cognac and our shareholders to be involved in advocacy?
Well, with my background working in state politics when I was a young man, I saw that the importance of organizations working together and supporting the needs of their village communities, quite frankly. And back around 2016, 2017, the board was having a strategic planning session, and they were talking about a concern that they had about our shares of stock that would be handed down from generation to generation. And for instance, you take an original shareholder with 100 shares, and two generations later, you might have 10 shareholders holding 10 shares. And the ability to provide a meaningful dividend to those 10 shareholders holding 10 shares was going to be challenging. And there was questions as to whether Cognac would be able to provide a meaningful dividend to those 10 shareholders holding 10 shares. And so what could Cognac do if we weren't able to do a lot for them monetarily to keep them interested and keep them engaged and actually provide something to that shareholder and descendant who's going to be a shareholder? And with my political background, I piped up and said, well, we could get involved with matters of public policy that impact our communities and our shareholders in a positive way. Things like supporting our schools, supporting capital projects in the villages, working on issues that are important to the communities that go through the political arena, be it municipal, state, or federal. That's something that we could do that benefits our people beyond the monetary benefits. And kind of sort of to my surprise, the board said, yeah, that's a good idea. And so, I mean, we'd been involved in those things more or less over the years, but I think at that point there was a decision to make a concerted effort to get more involved in matters of public policy that could benefit our villages, our shareholders, our descendants, support our tribes and our corporations. So that's my recollection of where this greater emphasis on advocacy came from.
Yeah, thank you. You mentioned some of them just now, but I'm curious to hear what some of the issues that you and the rest of the advocacy team work on a daily basis.
Sure. Well, I mean, we put together an annual plan of advocacy issues. We break them into short and long-term issues. And sometimes, and we define short-term as 1 to 3 years to accomplish something. And a long-term goal is something that is longer than 3 years. And this year, for the first time, we rolled an issue from a short-term issue to a long-term issue because it's going to take longer to work on it. But some of the things that are on that plan are things like advocating for access to fisheries in our villages. I mean, we've seen over the years, gosh, I can remember working for the legislature in the 80s, and the population of Old Harbor was in the 300s, you know, Yuzinki, Port Lions was, you know, pushing 250, and those communities are half of that today. And I remember, you know, I went to work for a legislature fresh out of college, and I didn't know much about the rest of the state. All I knew about was my region was Kodiak Island. And working for a legislature, I learned about other areas of the state, and I could see out in Western Alaska where, gosh, they didn't have water and sewer. They didn't, you know, they didn't have runways. They didn't have a lot of things that we had in our villages. And one thing that we had in our villages that they did not have for sure was the ability to make a living by going fishing. They didn't have any way to make a living. And over time, with these different fisheries management schemes, starting with state limited entry and subsequently federal individual fishing quotas in the 90s, we've seen an outmigration of permits. We've seen the loss of fishing quota in the villages for halibut and black cod. And we think that has been, to a great degree, the cause of the population declines in the villages, right? Folks unable to make a living. They move out. Their kids go. The population of the schools goes down. We now have 2 out of our 6 villages schools that are not open due to having not sufficient enrollment. You know, so that's, we think, is tied to fishery. And I think it's tied to a lot of other things as well. But those types of things are things that we want to work on and support, right? Good education in a village. That's another reason why people would move out, is if they don't feel their kids are getting a good education. So working on those type of things. Another issue we're working on, that we just had some conversations with entities in Southeast about working together on, is the Marine Mammal Protection Act blood quantum issue. The regulations that were promulgated after the Marine Mammal Protection Act was passed, the regulations state that in order to harvest marine mammals in Alaska, you have to be 1/4 blood quantum. They basically took the definition of native with the 1/4 blood quantum that was an ANCSA and put it in regulation to support the Marine Mammal Protection Act. Well, we've seen over the generations, I mean, our region was the first one that had contact, right? And so we've seen the mixing of the blood, be it from the you know, the Scandinavian folks to Russians to you name it, longer than most of the other regions in the state. And due to a report from Dr. Steve Langan of UAA in 2016, he showed that the Gulf Coast regions had a higher percentage of their people that had a lower blood quantum. And for the younger generations, as they're applying for certificates of Indian blood from the BIA, was showing our region, and I think Southeast, is having the greatest acceleration of those CIBs not meeting the blood quantum requirements. So what we're seeing is generations coming up that are not legally able to participate in customary and traditional practices. And what that will ultimately lead to is, I mean, it's already cultural repression today, but that will lead to, you know, cultural genocide, in my opinion, in a few more generations. So we're working that issue. We're trying to work with other regions, particularly in the Gulf Coast region, that have seen the same type of thing happening in their communities, because, you know, we don't measure blood quantum. And, you know, if somebody's a native, they're a native, and they shouldn't not be able to participate in those customary and traditional practices that are being taught in our cultural camps, right? To kids that don't have the blood quantum. And it's just, it's extremely sad that we're in this situation, and it need to stop, and it need to stop today, because every child born today that does not have that blood quantum is, you know, is potentially going to miss out on a big part of their culture. And that's just flat out not right. And we need to fix that. So that's the type of one of the issues that we're working on.
Absolutely. And I can tell how passionate you are about the issues that you mentioned. And I know there are other issues that you work on all the time that you're very passionate about. Now, let's just go back to the beginning. Where did you grow up? What was that like? Any stories from your childhood?
Sure. I was born and raised in Kodiak. I was born in 1961 at Griffin Memorial Hospital, which is that little white square building across the street from the Illitik Museum. Kindergarten through 12th grade at Kodiak Public Schools, Main Elementary, Kodiak Junior High, and Kodiak High School. Yeah, it was a fun place and time to grow up as a kid there. My recollection of it was that winters were colder and snowier than they are today. I can remember in my folks' backyard, my buddies and I digging snow tunnels under the snow. It was that deep. I can remember us taking plastic buckets and plastic garbage cans and filling up the snow and turning upside down, making forts and having giant snowball fights. I can remember a bunch of us having races on our sleds down the hill in the field behind the house, and then when our parents weren't watching on the street. And then that was winter times. We were outside playing all the time. I can remember taking some of my friends and I taking our 22s, and our one dad would drop us off and the other one would pick us up at a designated time and place a few hours later and going rabbit hunting. And those type of things were fun. Summertime was until I got to be age to go out on my dad's fishing boat and go seining, was all about Little League, all about baseball. And I was on the Elks Club Little League team. I tell people that as I've gotten older and I see someone that might be a little older than me and we didn't play Little League, but they were a few years older, I pick out one of the six Little League teams and say, I bet you were on Bankers or you were on Sutliff's or whatever. And most of the time I'm right. And I don't know what it is about being able to pick out a Little League team that somebody played on based on their personality, but it's kind of funny when I think back on it. So yeah, summer's all about baseball. And then when I was 11, I got to go out on dad's boat for the first time and just plunged and didn't get paid till I was 13. I started getting a half share when I was 13 and fished with dad in the summers up through about college. I sometimes when I got in my later teens in college, I might go with another boat early in the season for reds because dad didn't fish reds. Then I might jump on another boat at the end of the season after dad had hung it up. But yeah, so that was kind of growing up in Kodiak. It was a great place to grow up. Lots of fun. Everybody knew each other. Couldn't get away with anything because their parents would find out because it was a small town. So it was a great place to grow up. My wife, who grew up in Nome, and I often say that we had the best childhoods in the communities we grew up in and the era that we grew up in.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've heard stories just like yours from, you know, other people in my family and in our communities. You mentioned college. I'm curious to hear your experience, you know, young adulthood, you know, up until you joined Kodiak.
Sure. So growing up for me, school came easy for me other than penmanship. I remember fourth grade, Mrs. Breckberg handed out report cards and she squatted down next to me and she called me Thomas. She said, Thomas, I'm so disappointed in you. I thought I had a great report card. And she said, you would have gotten straight A's if you would work on your penmanship. And I opened up my report card. I got an A in everything except penmanship. I got a C-. So that was one subject in elementary school I really struggled with. But school kind of came easy for me. And I can't tell you when exactly it was, but it was pretty early on that I realized that I wanted to go on to college. And I didn't know what I wanted to do. Things I wanted to do kind of went back and forth depending on what I had seen in the somewhere on TV or whatever that I thought was really cool. But I was pretty convinced early on that I wasn't bound to be a commercial fisherman. So I knew I was kind of college bound, didn't know what that meant, where that would go. I had a very small world view. We didn't have internet, you know, for a long time as a kid. We had one TV channel and that was off of the base. That came on at some time in the morning and went down off at some time at night. So didn't have a lot of exposure to the outside world, but I knew there was a big world out there and I wanted to experience it. So in college, every year it seemed like I had a different plan of where I was going to go to college and what I was going to study. And ultimately I ended up going to the University of Oregon in Eugene. And the way I ended up deciding on Oregon was just kind of happenstance. I went in the counselor's office at the high school and they had this stand that had trifold brochures from colleges. And I saw Oregon, I saw University of Washington. I was really thinking about University of Washington, but I had the SAT score. I had the grade point average, but University of Washington required 2 years of foreign language for an out-of-state student. And I didn't have that, but Oregon did not. And so I thought, okay, I meet everything here. And I thought, well, they're in the pack, it might have been the Pac-8 back then or Pac-10 sports conference, and I was big into sports. So, wow, I can go there and I could watch a USC football team. I can watch a UCLA basketball team. That sounds good to me. So that's where I applied and I got accepted and went to U of O as a business major. I graduated with a BS in finance. Surprises a lot of people when I tell them that, because they, based on my work history, fresh out of college, went into politics in general. A lot of people think I was a political science major or pre-law. I've even been accused of being a lawyer before, and God forbid. But anyway, I was a finance major. And college, I didn't know a soul when I went to school. My folks took me to see, we went to Seattle. I bought new clothes, and they put me on an airplane at Seattle Airport bound for Eugene. And I'd never stepped foot in the state of Oregon in my life and didn't know anybody at a school whose enrollment was three times the size of the population of the community I grew up with. So it was scary. I was bound and determined not to wash out. That first semester, September to December, felt like about 50 years. But then things settled down. You know, I made friends and got accustomed to things and had a great experience, really enjoyed it. And I'm a diehard Duck fan today. So follow all Duck sports and cheer heartily for them.
As a graduate of the University of Washington, I am not a Ducks fan.
Yeah, there's a couple of you in the office here that I have to contend with.
No, but they're both great schools, but I will not be joining you and in watching those games. So how about you mentioned your career in Juneau. Any insight from that career?
Yeah, so people often ask how I got into that job, and I didn't get through my bachelor's program at U of O in 4 years. I had to go an extra semester, in all honesty, because I spent some time majoring in social life rather than my degree pass. And so it took me a little longer to get through. And I came home in December of 83 and needed, my folks were like, hey, you're done with school. You need to get a job. And I won't give you the whole path, but I found out that Kodiak State Senator Bob Mulcahy had a staff opening, and he wanted someone from the district because the opening was created by someone from Kodiak that was not coming back. And basically, to get my mother in particular off my back, I didn't want the job. I reached out through contacts to the senator and got an interview with him. And lo and behold, 10 days later, I was in Juneau going into a job that I didn't necessarily want in a field that I had a great disdain for, politics. But, serendipity, it turned out to be the greatest thing that could happen to me, probably. So I was 22 years old when I went down to Juneau for the first time as a staffer, green around the gills, and learned a lot. Sir Mulcahy did that year. He retired that year. And Fred Jaroff, who had been in the House representing Kodiak, ran for the Senate seat, won it, and offered me a job. And so I went to work for Fred, and I worked for Fred through his 12 years in the Senate. And Fred was great. He kept challenging me. He kept giving, every year he'd give me more to do. First couple of years, I was learning the ropes. I was responding to constituent requests, drafting letters, maybe get assigned a bill that he introduced to do the backup work on. But then maybe the next year I'd come down, he'd say, okay, you've got the capital budget for the district. And then the next day, okay, you're covering the operating budget for the district. So, as his Senate career evolved and my staffing career evolved, I got to work 6 years for him while he was on the Senate Finance Committee, 4 when he was in a majority, 2 when he was in a minority. After he did his finance time, I guess it was between the majority and the minority stint on the finance, he was chair of the Senate Rules Committee. I got to be the rules aide and rules is part of Senate leadership. So I got to experience that. And I got to get my hands dirty working on the legislative work and understanding the process. And he was defeated and had run for reelection in 1996. And I wasn't sure what I was going to do. I knew I needed a job. And lo and behold, I landed a job with Representative Reggie Jewell out of Kotzebue. And that was a whole new experience because, all those previous years I was working for Kodiak State Senator. And although our Senate district, like when I first started, the Senate district went all the way out to Chain. It had Bristol Bay and the Pribilofs up to Lake Iliamna. And so, big district, and I got to meet people from all of that area, but still, the district was kind of home ported in Kodiak. But working for a legislator from Kotzebue, who also had the North Slope and Barrow, completely different, didn't know anybody, didn't really know their issues. It was a great experience. One, Reggie was a great guy to work for, just a superhuman being, and treated me really well. I got to meet a lot of really great people from that region. I got to understand their issues better. And it was just those 16 sessions I worked for our legislature was just a tremendous experience, and I would really love to see some of our younger folks have a similar path. Maybe they don't need to stay 16 years, but get down there and work your way up. Don't do it for 5, 6, 7, 8 years, and don't just be the person that is answering the phone, is scheduling the appointments and that type of stuff. Every year, take on a little bit more, like I had the opportunity to do, and really get to where you know the ins and outs of that process. It's valuable. And kind of the strategy, particularly Fred was in rules. I was exposed to some of the strategy between the House and the Senate and the governor as they're trying to figure out how to wrap up an end of a session and get your body's priorities, but also try to negotiate with the others to get there. Is it really a tremendous experience that for me, it taught me a lot, but even more so, it was the relationships that I built. There are people that are in significant roles in not even Native corporations that are elsewhere that I was staff with, and we might have gone to the gym and played basketball, or we might have had a beer together, or we had things where staff would go to a beach at night and or on a weekend and, have a kind of a big picnic and all that. So those relationships have stuck with me for the rest of my career. And we might not cross paths for years and years. An example is just recently I found out that a young person that was a young man when he was an intern in our office in 1992 or 1993 is now in leadership at the regional office at U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and we're doing a lot of work with Fish and Wildlife Service right now, and so he's just getting hired on there. So when I heard the name, I was like, oh my gosh, that's 30 years ago that I was breaking him in on the legislative process when he was an intern. So, at this stage of life, I look back at that, at those things, and just think, wow, that's really cool.
So thinking about that experience in Juneau and state politics, how did you first get involved with Koniak?
So I was in Juneau and working for Senator Zhuroff, and AFN was in town and they had a reception one evening, and I went down to the reception and I ran into Koniak's president at the time, Frank Pagano, and I'd known Frank virtually all my life. He was a family friend. My dad was in the mission on Whidi Island with Frank. Frank was a few years younger, and I hadn't seen him in a number of years, and he just asked me, well, I heard you were down here, and I think he asked me, I heard that Uriah went to college, what did I get my degree in, blah, blah, blah. And he said that there was going to be one of the board members, incumbent board members who was up for election, was not going to run, and I should consider running for the board. And I don't remember what I said. I kind of chuckled and said, yeah, sure, right, something like that, and forgot about it. And then months later, the legislative session was over. I was back in Kodiak, and Peter Olson, who was on the board then, and Peter and I grew up together, went to school together, and Peter works for Koniak, obviously. He was on the board then, and he called me up, and we went to lunch, and he said, yeah, Frank told me you want to run for the board, and, the deadline to submit your name is coming up, and if you want, I can help get the paperwork for you and all that kind of stuff. And I thought, I don't remember committing to that, but... But anyway, I put my name in and was elected to the board, and that was in October of 1986. And so that's how I got involved with Koniak. I didn't intentionally do it. I was just kind of, I guess maybe recruited might be kind of sort of the way it happened.
Yeah. So what has your journey been with Koniak since you were recruited?
Well, it's been quite a ride. The Grateful Dead had a song where one of the lines in it says, what a long, strange trip it's been. And that certainly applies here. We were very small. We had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, maybe 6 employees enterprise-wide. What do we have now? 3,000? We didn't really have any business operations. There had been business operations previously, but by the time I got on the board, they had either failed or been shut down. Our main sources of revenue were 7i and a payment from Chevron for, we were looking at doing a land trade to get a parcel in Anwar at the time. There are several Native corporations looking at that. They were called the mega trades back in those days. Ultimately, that didn't happen, but they were making an annual payment to us. And those are really what was keeping the lights on at Koniak. And You know, Koenig was kind of in survival mode, and I think a turtle with its arms and legs and head pulled in and holding on to every nickel that came in. So it was, you know, to start with Koenig and that be where we were, to be where we are today, it's, I couldn't have fathomed it back then. Where we are today, I couldn't have fathomed 15 years ago. So it's, you know, it's been a remarkable ride. Lots of ups, lots of downs, lots of super well-intentioned people that are no longer with us, you know, that have passed, that I got a chance to, I didn't know before, they got a chance to meet and work with, either serve on the board with or as an employee. There's some really, really great people. Lots of laughs, lots of hard work, lots of staring at the ceiling at night, thinking about things at times. And yeah, it's been a ride. You know, we invested in companies, sold lands, did real estate transactions, tried to create a, kind of got premature in trying to create the infrastructure to support the type of company we are now, about 10 years ago. So, and then had to retrench from that. And, you know, then to see the building be built in Kodiak, you know, re-headquartered it back in Kodiak and replant that flag there and be visible in the community. And now we're, you know, I think we're becoming more visible in the community and being a, you know, a good corporate citizen in the community. So, you know, that makes me proud that, you know, Koenig is something that folks that aren't Koenig shareholders, I think they look at it and they don't really understand what it is, but they recognize that it's there and that it has financial viability behind it, which brings it clout, which helps me in what I do. And so, yeah, it's just been, you know, kind of go through 35 years with you here is too much, but it's been one incredible experience to just watch what's happened and be involved with what's happened in this corporation over that 3.5 decades.
Absolutely. If you could, you know, use some words or some phrases about how you've seen Koenig change over the years, how would you describe it?
I think Koenig has become more pragmatic. This is the word that I would use. There was a lot of entrenching into positions and being unwilling to listen to the other position. And over time, you know, a lot of those things have gotten further and further in our rearview mirror. And over time, with different leadership, it's evolved with each new leader at Koenig. I think over time, we've become more open. We've become more willing to engage and listen with open ears. And I've not seen a time at Koenig when those who were involved weren't trying to do what they felt was in the best interest of the corporation, even though, you know, at times it may have rankled others. But I think everybody that's been involved, that I've been involved with, whether I agreed with them or not, honestly felt like they were doing what was in the best interest of the corporation. But I think today we've gotten to the point where we worked hard to establish our trusting relationship with our shareholders. And, you know, we're not all the way there, and you're never going to be, right? But we're probably better off than we ever have been in terms of our shareholder relations and the information that we provide to shareholders. And I think we've evolved to a point where and it's, you know, to see it evolve to that took a lot of pragmatism on behalf of a lot of leadership over the years. And, I guess where we're at today, I would put the way we operate with our shareholders, the way we operate within our region, with our tribes and corporations, up against any other region. I would put the talent that we have working at Koenig and the capabilities of our board of directors up against any other corporation. I don't think it can't be matched. You know, starting at the top with our board, when we have a board meeting, every time we're done with a board meeting, I'm always just kind of, wow, you know, we got positive, constructive criticism from the board. They added value, you know, they had good suggestions on stuff that we didn't think about when we were working on things. And there's no effort to try to gotcha or or tear you down, you know, from a management team perspective. And it hasn't always been that way. And, you know, it's gratifying. It makes it a wonderful work environment. It makes it something to be proud to be part of. And I, you know, as I see other organizations, native organizations struggle with those type of things, I think we've evolved a lot over the years. And there were some hard lessons to be learned over those times. But we're always striving to be better too. We're not resting on our laurels, and we're not going to be complacent. And we talk about that a lot at the strategic planning sessions. We can't be complacent. You know, we've just built a foundation to continue to grow in all regards. So anyway, it's challenging, but it's also fun.
Thinking back over your years here at Koniag, are there any stories that you remember and would like to recount for our listeners?
I can think of a lot of stories, but if I did that, I would either disparage others or I would disparage myself. But, you know, I guess I go back to our corporate values and the one that is having pride in your work, and the statement that accompanies that. I think it's the last sentence of the statement that accompanies having pride in your work. It says, "We work hard, but we don't take ourselves too seriously." And that is my favorite part of our core values. And I think it is totally true, and it epitomizes it. And, you know, when I left the board in 97, and then I came back 3 years later as an employee in 2000, and I can't remember a time when, even when things were really stressful, when there wasn't laughter in the office, right? Boy, there was a period when we were in the old building, and a gang of ladies who worked in the office would have lunch in the boardroom together every day, and they would have the newspaper, and they'd be reading their horoscopes to each other as they ate their sandwiches. And the shrieks of laughter that were coming out of that boardroom were heard down the hall, to the point where people would go down and say, "What's going on in here?" They were having so much fun on their lunch break, you know, reading their horoscopes and imagining scenarios based on those horoscopes and all that. And it was really a lot of fun. And then, of course, there were, you know, our situations and instances that come up that I'm gonna keep to myself. But those who have worked here and are listening to this, they can probably remember a few, and they probably have some good story on me too. So I'll leave it at that.
All right, let's end on a positive note. Tom Panamira,
Koniag's Regional and Legislative Affairs Executive, thank you very much for joining us and being our very first guest.
Thank you, Tyler. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. And this has been the I Am Koniag podcast. Thank you for listening to our very first episode. We'll see you next time.